this morning, United States versus Collins. Mr. Soliday.
May it please the court. My client, Mr. Collins, feels that his sentence is 24 months too high than it should have been. He pled guilty to all 22 counts filed against him. He received the maximum sentence on counts 1 through 11, and then counts 12 through 22 were 1028A counts. And we argue that the sentence was basically 24 months above a guideline sentence. The reason for that is under guideline 5G1.2, the commentary note, there are three factors that the court can look at to decide whether to run those 1028A counts concurrently or consecutively. Mr. Collins met all three of those factors. His was not a crime of violence. The offenses were groupable. And a concurrent sentence would have met the goals of Section 3553A. The court didn't mention that guideline or the commentary during the sentencing hearing. It was brought to the court's attention in the defendant's first sentencing memo. There was really two hearings. The first hearing was an evidentiary hearing over some disputed guideline issues, and the second hearing was basically the court ruled on those, made decisions on those guideline objections, and then announced his sentence. That guideline was also in the pre-sentence report. Another factor that...
Counsel, I'm under the impression the court doesn't have to mention every single argument in announcing its decision. That's true or not true?
I would probably say that's true, Your Honor, yes. And in this case, he did mention there were a lot of contested issues, and he did touch upon a lot of different things during his decision when he announced it to the parties. A couple other things that weren't mentioned by the court, that were brought to the court's attention by the defense, were my client's cooperation during a proffer with the government. There was no 5K motion filed by the government. He did sit down with an agent and basically explained in detail how he committed this crime, answered the agent's questions, also identified about 21 pictures he went through. They were asking about different people, who they were. He also had a factor which we believe was relevant, namely that his traumatic childhood, he did witness his mother shoot his father, which I'm sure has a traumatic impact on anyone. And we would think that under the guideline that since Mr. Collins met those three factors under the commentary to 5G1.2, that the court should have run all those concurrent versus running one of them, well, two were run consecutive. So Mr. Collins believes that a maximum sentence of the 60 months, followed by a consecutive sentence of 24 months, for a total of 84 months imprisonment, would have been sufficient to meet the goals of sentencing. With that, I'd like to save my time for rebuttal.
Sometimes a sentencing judge will not mention an open court cooperation out of concern that somebody may be sitting in court that might use that against the defendant and talk to other people. Would you agree that that happens?
I do agree that that can happen. In my experience in 18 years, I haven't had that happen. Usually there's a motion, or 5K motion by the government, and the court will just sort of generically say, I'll grant that motion and depart downward two levels or whatever based upon his cooperation. So usually there's some mention of it to some extent, I think. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alder. Ms. Trimble-Harris.
Good Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jill Trumbull-Harris. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in Hammond, Indiana, and I represent the government in this appeal. The defendant, Garjon Collins, was sentenced on 22 counts of aggravated identity theft and misuse of a Social Security number. In fact, there were 11 different counts of each of those offenses in the indictment for 11 of the defendants, ultimately 23 victims that were proven up at sentencing and that the court found he was responsible for. He's challenging his sentence today in this appeal on reasonableness grounds, and because he does not raise any procedural issues regarding his sentencing, the abuse of discretion standard applies. So the question is, was it an abuse of discretion for the district court to sentence the defendant to 108 months or 9 years for these 22 identity theft-related offenses? And the government's position is that it was not. The defendant on the first 11 counts faced a guideline range of 63 to 78 months. And on the 11 other counts, the aggravated identity theft counts, he faced up to 22 years, up to 11 consecutive sentences of 2 years each for each of those counts. In this instance, the district judge decided to run two of those 11 aggravated identity theft sentences consecutive to one another to punish the defendant for his, we believe, multiple victims, his recidivism, and other characteristics. That was not an abuse of the district court's discretion. That was fully within his discretion. Both Congress in the statute itself, 1028 Big A, and the guidelines, the Sentencing Commission in drafting the guidelines, provided that the district judge has the discretion that he exercised in exactly this case. And if it were an abuse of discretion for the judge to have exercised that discretion, given his lengthy explanation in this case of all the reasons why he did that, then that language in the statute and the language in the sentencing guidelines is meaningless. In fact, the statute and the guidelines anticipate that the judge would do exactly what he did here, which is you don't get a free pass for stealing 11 identities just because for stealing one you would get one consecutive two-year sentence. He was punished by having an additional 24-month consecutive sentence added on.
Didn't you argue for a longer sentence, even four months per victim or something like that?
I did, Your Honor. I argued for 10 years, which was a within-guideline sentence if the court had accepted the government's arguments regarding the number of victims and the amount of loss.
And those were rejected in terms of he found fewer victims than 30, I think, wasn't it?
That's right. The government argued that there were 30 victims that the defendant should be held responsible for, not just the 11 that he was convicted for and the 12 that his separately indicted co-conspirators were convicted for stealing, but also 7 that the defendant stole in the period of 2002 to 2004. And we argued that this defendant should be held accountable for those victims and for the losses to those victims and the loss amount that as the court calculated, but the court disagreed and found the lower amount, the 23 victims instead, and the just over $170,000 loss amount. And in doing so, the district court explained his reasons and gave a lengthy explanation at the final sentencing hearing, where he explained that this sentence was necessary to provide just punishment for the defendant, who was again charged and convicted of 22 different identity theft-related crimes, and that the sentence was necessary to reflect the seriousness of the defendant's criminal conduct, which was extensive, and as I've mentioned, went beyond just the 11 victims in his indictment. It went to the other 12 that his co-conspirators all stole their identities with the defendant's help, and the fact that the defendant was operating a business out of his home to sell stolen goods that he obtained after getting these fake IDs. What this defendant would do is we found out through the proffer, which I'd like to address in a second, that he went onto a legal database and he looked up mortgage information. And if you lived in a particular neighborhood in the North Shore of Chicago and your mortgage was above a certain amount, typically above $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, he figured you had good credit. So he stole your identity, he created fake birth certificates, and pay stubs and other documents, and he had himself and his co-conspirators go to the Indiana Department of Motor Vehicles and obtain Indiana state IDs in the names of his victims. Then they would go to big box stores like Best Buy and Lowe's and Home Depot, and they would open instant credit accounts using the victims' good credit. And then they would buy certain items at those stores, many of which the defendant kept a list of what he needed to buy because there were people in his community who wanted to purchase them from the defendant at half price. And that was the business that he was operating out of his house. Now, that references the defendant's cooperation. During the investigation, the government became aware that the defendant's sister worked for a credit reporting agency, and we became concerned and began to investigate if that was the source of where he was getting this information about his victims. That was why the defendant agreed to participate in a proffer situation. It wasn't to provide any additional information on criminal wrongdoing by anyone other than himself. And for that reason, the government didn't file a 5K. And the defendant didn't raise the subject of his cooperation at either of the two sentencing hearings that the judge, where the judge heard evidence. And in fact, if he had, the government would have responded accordingly. But that never came up. The defendant never raised those issues. And that is also true of the traumatic childhood that the defendant wants this court to recognize. He never asked the district court to recognize that during either of the two sentencing hearings that were held, although he did raise it in a sentencing memorandum that was filed several months before the judge ultimately issued his sentence. Ultimately, what this defendant received was a sentence that is 6 months above the guideline range if you calculate the guideline range as whatever the underlying offense is produced, which in this case was a range of 63 to 78 months, plus one consecutive 24-month sentence for the aggravated identity theft charge. So what he got was just 6 months above that. And we do not believe that that sentence, based on all the evidence that the government presented to the court, was an abuse of the district court's decision or discretion, and would note what the district court, a couple of things in evidence that the district court found to be very persuasive. And those things were that this defendant had been convicted before in the Northern District of Indiana, and he had appeared in front of Judge Lozano at sentencing in that case. And at that sentencing hearing, he had previously submitted to the court a letter apologizing for his offenses and had made certain statements to the judge, to the district judge. And in the letter, he basically says evil forces caused him to do the harm that he did. And during the sentencing hearing, he swore to the judge, and he was under oath, that he would never again engage in any criminal activity again. And in this case, Judge Van Bocklin found the defendant's immediate return upon being released from prison to engaging in the same type of illegal activity he had been engaged in before to be particularly offensive and show that the defendant had no regard for the law and, in fact, was a danger to society and would recidivate if given the opportunity again. The court also felt that the letter from the defendant in the instant case was disingenuous because it was very similar to the letter he had provided to Judge Lozano in the past. And those were, along with some of the evidence that was found in the defendant's home, which included a how-to book on how to commit identity theft crimes, portions of which were read into the record by the judge, and also included newspaper articles about identity theft laws in Illinois, showed that the defendant's conduct in this case was knowing and intentional.
And wasn't there a statement he made to someone about, catch me if you can, tell the police that?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The defendant, there was testimony that the defendant had told his girlfriend prior to his arrest, if the cops question you, tell them, catch me if they can. And a copy of that video, interestingly, was found in the defendant's bedroom, along with all of this other evidence of his criminal activity, which included an entire file cabinet that the government admitted into evidence at trial because it was filled with the names and telephone numbers and home addresses, social security numbers of possible future victims. And again, none of that was accounted for in just the 11 aggravated identity theft and aggravated, misuse of a social security number charge that the defendant was convicted of. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
How much time?
In response to the government, I think raising an issue in a sentencing memo or verbally, you don't waive it by not raising it verbally.
And it's certainly not wrong to do it long in front of sentencing because judges prefer to get things early.
Correct. Judge Van Bocklin wanted sentencing memos 15 days before the first sentencing hearing, which we both filed, and I did raise the cooperation in that sentencing memo. With regard to why he proffered, I can tell you that my client proffered in hopes of getting a 5K, not under a threat of a sister being charged with any type of crime. With regard to that, unless the court has any questions, that's all I have.
Mr. Salde, you were appointed by the court, were you, to represent the defendant?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have the appreciation of the court, as your other colleagues have this morning, and for a vigorous representation of your client. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.